Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org.
Hello, Mormon Stories listeners. This is Dan Weatherspoon. I am excited to host another one of these conversations for the Mormon Stories podcast, in addition to the Mormon Matters ones that I do. And I am with a very good friend of mine today. He is the kind of guy that I just think far more Latter-day Saints need to meet. He is extremely bright. He's so energetic. He is so likable, and he's incredibly smart. And, you know, just one of those cool Mormons that everyone deserves to know. And his name is Jim McLaughlin. Jim is a professor at Western Carolina University back in North Carolina. And we'll get a feel for his philosophy and the things that he does as we go along here. But, Jim, welcome to the Mormon Stories podcast.
Hi, Dan.
We kind of came to deciding to do this, and I ran it by John DeLynn as an episode for this, and he was really excited about it. John has known you off and on through Sunstone contacts and things as well, and finds you fascinating, and so we think our listeners will really enjoy it. By the time this releases, many of you listeners will have heard Jim already on the Mormon Matters podcast. He and I and Dwayne Jeffrey and Stephen Peck, a couple of biologists or scientists at BYU, are going to be recording an episode on the history of evolution in the church and controversies at BYU that we're now exactly 100 years from, so we're marking the anniversary of that. So many of you will have heard Jim a little bit on that, and hopefully that's given you a great tease to be excited to dive into this. So, Jim, this is Mormon Stories, and what we normally do at Mormon Stories is have our guests basically share whatever pieces of their growing up and formative years and turning points and all that stuff that's helped them shape their worldview. So I'm going to mostly turn you loose, prompt you here for maybe a little more clarification from time to time, but I really would love you just to dive in and stuff. So where were you born, and take it from there?
Well, I was born in Salt Lake City, not in a hospital. But
Already we're getting the Jim McLaughlin personality here. I love it.
I grew up in Taylorsville, Utah, on what was left of my grandparents' 30-acre farm. My great-grandmother, Margaret Naismith, had bought the farm for a dollar from my great-grandfather, William McLaughlin, during the polygamy raids. And she lived out there and, raised her kids. She lost three of them in one day to scarlet fever, and I'm telling you this because my ancestors are, for me, Mormonism is kind of like ancestor veneration. So anyway, she raised her kids out there. My grandfather John McLaughlin took over the farm and raised a bunch of kids who became both Mormon and Jack Mormon. But they all had this kind of belief in the thing. My dad, James West McLaughlin, grew up, these were Depression-era kids. Dad saved money and went on a mission and entered the mission home on December 7th, 1941, went up to the Northwestern States Mission.
Wow.
Walked around out there. People they liked him, but they also, you got a lot of why aren't you out fighting the war stuff. So when he got released from his mission in 1944, came back to Utah, joined the Merchant Marines, and served out the war in the Pacific. Important story here. His brother Marvin had joined the Marine Corps and was killed at Okinawa just before, a few days before the end of the war. And he had this, I'll tell this story now, and I won't tell the whole thing because it's kind of, too sacred to share with a mass audience. But he had an experience of his mother coming to him on the ship and telling him what happened to his brother. And for me, as we'll get into this, and I think my testimony of the church is kind of how would you say, eccentric. Okay.
I love it.
That's an important part of it. This story that he told me and exists in my family of this experience he had. But anyway, survived. You know, he survived the war and went home and back to Utah. Wanted to farm, but you know that making a living as a farmer is fairly hard. So he ended up working at Kennecott Copper. And though he voted Republican, he was a union man, and so you know that was important to me too when I was growing up. My mother, really interesting story. She grew up in New Jersey. Well, her family was Pennsylvania German from, but she ended up in New Jersey, and she found a book called The Proselyte about the Mormons and read it. And then found the Book of Mormon in the library and read it and decided she wanted to become a Mormon when she was in her early teens. And her parents were Presbyterian, and of course, you know, Mormons didn't have that great a reputation back in the 30s and 40s. thought she'd gone nuts. She eventually did join the church when she was 21, came out to Utah and met my father. But she became this kind of avid genealogist. She had been already before she joined the church. And so this idea of the importance of not just your own story, but the going back into the story of your ancestors was always important for me. We used to spend our summers. She was in cemeteries in Pennsylvania. This is my idea of how vacations were spent when I was little.
Too funny.
Beating tombstones with flour sacks so we could try and read them. But later, as I got older, I found out that other people didn't spend their summer vacations that way, and I felt kind of cheated. But it was still a good experience. I still love to go into cemeteries now.
Very interesting.
They aren't scary places for me. But anyway, you know, I grew up with them. My mother, I didn't read the scriptures when I was a kid, but my mother read them to us. She read us the Book of Mormon. And you grow up, you know, out there, you go up in the mountains and you wonder if Nephites were hanging out. You know, childlike ways of looking at things maybe. But, you know, so I grew up out there. One of the important things of my youth was I grew up out there with my uncles and aunts and cousins. A lot of them were Jack Mormons, but they'd all come down and they'd have these wonderful kind of speculative conversations. My Uncle Scott would tell J. Golden Kimball stories. My Uncle Ralph, who believed in the healing virtues of early time whiskey. They called him the prof, though. He liked to prophesy, and he would talk kind of speculative Mormon theology, but they would all do this this kind of stuff. I had two aunts that were fairly active in the church, but they would get together, and you just get this kind of interesting, wild speculations going on about the church and about the gospel. My dad didn't graduate from high school until he was in his 40s, but he read B.H. Roberts and John A. Whitstow and James Talmage, so I was raised with that kind of stuff in my background, plus a lot of, you know, wonderfully weird stuff as well. So it was good. But then, you know, when I was about 12, we sold the farm, moved over to the east side of the valley, and that kind of sacred space sort of disappeared. You know, it was, and you know what West Valley's like now. It's
right, right. You keep talking about, you know, way out there in Taylorsville, and it's all connected now.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's like, you know, strip malls, and, you know, it's the sacred space is gone. So that actually, you know, theologically is quite important to me, too, because I don't feel tied to places. You know, maybe it's because I had to move to North Carolina too, as much as I thought that I would be. You know, that there are these sacred ancestral grounds, and you're tied to them. Or, you know, anyway, but So I went to high school, and we lived in Holladay. I went to high school there at Olympus High School, which was at the time an odd mixture of the upper classes and the working class. The east side of the valley now is probably all, fairly wealthy people. But I remember going there, and I was a terrible student. Well, not terrible. I wouldn't even be called what you call a slacker now, I don't think. I had a C average. I didn't think I was going to be going to college. I remember the Vietnam War was going on, and a bunch of us being herded into an assembly with the Army recruiters telling us that if we joined, we wouldn't have to be frontline soldiers. But since our grades were so bad, we were probably going to end up drafted and in there. But my senior year, I had some really wonderful teachers, and I discovered Dostoevsky. I discovered debate. I quit playing football, which was good because I wasn't a very good football player. My contribution to teams was holding the tackling dummies.
Oh, man.
I realized I could never be a farmer because I went up and spent a summer working on a farm in Idaho and realized I would starve to death. But I discovered I had an English teacher who had us read Crime and Punishment. I read Dostoevsky and I was like, incredible. And then I was always a fairly good history student. So, I had another teacher, Mr. Tolman, in AP History. Mark Hoffman was in my class.
Very interesting.
And Mark was a quiet guy. We didn't talk much. He was already busy doing his work. But that was a great experience. But one of the things that happened was I was taking a class, and we were told to read books, find a book. And my sister had read Mark Twain's The Mysterious Stranger. And she said I should read that. Plus, it was short. It was a...
Yay. The virtue of all high school reading choices.
Yeah, so it looked like something I could get done with. And then I just want to read one passage from this to you. Because this, when I read this book, which is one of the most depressing things I've ever read in my entire life, I read this, and I got to the end of it where, this angel, Lucifer, who's not the real Lucifer but his nephew, comes to these boys during the 30 Years' War in Germany. It's an amazing book because it's like no good deed goes unpunished. It's like, Cormac McCarthy. At the end of the book, after all these horrible things have happened to these boys and to anybody who they want to be blessed by this angel, who at one point, just a story about this, the boys to ask the angel to help this guy who has just had this miserable life, even though he's a good human being, and the angel goes over and touches him, and he goes mad. And the boy said, "Why do you do that to him?" He says, "Oh, don't you know, the only truly happy people are the insane."
Mark Twain at his finest attitude towards religion. Yeah,
yeah. If you really want to freak out your kids sometime, there's a Will Vinton. Remember Will Vinton and the California Raisins?
Vaguely.
There's a Will Vinton claymation movie called The Adventures of Mark Twain, which is a wonderful thing to watch. It's got stuff from the Adam and Eve diaries in it and everything like that. But it has a little section from The Mysterious Stranger. And I teach religion and film courses here at Western, and I always show this little clip. It only lasts about 3 minutes. It's in the middle of the movie. And it freaks out my college-age students. So imagine showing this to your five-year-old. Anyway, but it's a great movie. But anyway, the end of the book, the boy talks to Lucifer, to the angel, and asks him, what's going on? And the angel says, hey, don't you realize this has all just been your dream? So it's really dark. But what he says here was important to me. It was an important statement about God that has stayed with me ever since then, ever since I was 17 years old. And I'd like to read it.
Like, oh, that's fine. Yeah, I know the quote you're talking about. So yeah, it's a wild and crazy quote.
Okay, it says, strange that you should not have suspected years ago, centuries ago, eons ago, for you have existed companionless through all the eternities. Strange indeed, because you have not suspected that your universe and its content were only dreams, fiction. Strange because they are so frankly and hysterically insane. Like all dreams, a god who could make good children as easily as bad, yet preferred to make bad ones, who could have made every one of them happy, yet never made a single happy one, who made them prize their bitter life, yet stingily cut it short, who gave his angels eternal happiness unearned, yet required his other children to earn it, who gave his angels painless lives, yet cursed his other children with biting miseries and maladies of mind and body, who mouths justice and invented hell, who mouths mercy and invented hell, who mouths golden rules and forgiveness multiplied 70 times 7 and invented hell, who mouths morals to other people, yet has none himself, who frowns upon crimes, yet commits them all, who created man without invitation and tries to shuffle the responsibility for man's acts upon man, instead of honorably placing it where it belongs, upon himself. And finally, with altogether divine obtuseness, invites this poor, abused slave to worship him. You perceive now that these are impossible except in a dream. You perceive that they are pure and puerile insanities, the silly creations of an imagination that is not conscious of its freaks. In a word, they are a dream, and you are the maker of it. The dream marks are all present. You should have recognized them, Cyrillus. Excuse me. You should have recognized them earlier. I remember reading that. And just, I don't know. It just seemed true to me. Okay.
That this is an absurd god, or what is it that felt true to you? Yeah.
That believing in a god that controlled everything, that created that controlled people's destinies. People will get up and say, you know, God is sent. You know, when somebody suffers a horrible malady and said, God has sent me this trial, or, you know, and that just seems to me an impossible thing to believe. I know that many people believe it, and many really intelligent people believe this, and people who I respect and love believe it. But for me, it was, you know, when I reading this just resonated with something in me that I couldn't believe in that kind of a God.
Now, at this point, had you tied into the idea that Mormonism doesn't believe in that sort of God?
At least
most Mormons? Yeah, I'm trying to get...
Yeah, sort of. Mormons are... we'll talk about this later, but sometimes people will talk about Mormon theology, and I've come to believe that there is no Mormon theology. There are about 30 Mormon theologies.
Right.
I think this is true of pretty well all religions, is that there is the initial revelation or the initial experience, and then we try and explain it, and we explain it in a bunch of different ways. And I think it's a great thing to do theology. I love theology. It's what my uncles and aunts were speculating on as they sat in the house on Saturday night sometime. And so I did have a sense, I think, that the Mormon God wasn't like this. But you got hit from both sides. People are wonderfully inconsistent. Where on the one hand they talk about, you know, us being free and the preexistence, and then on the other hand you'd have this idea of absolute God who's in charge of everything that could possibly happen. So you know, the quote both struck me as remarkably true and screwed me up at the same time.
Have you recovered? No. Just
nobody. Yeah, it's like Freud says. Nobody ever fully recovers. You just get by. But at the time too, you know, I had made another decision about a year earlier. I'd quit going to seminary because I wanted to save my faith.
Wow, that's an interesting statement.
Well, you know, I found seminary the most faith-destroying thing that I ever experienced. They were nice people, but it was, at least for me, the stories and the sometimes, you know, it depended on the teacher, but the sometimes dogmatism was so out of line with the Mormonism I'd experienced from my my father and my mother and my aunts and uncles, some of them Jack Mormons, that it just didn't help me.
So you're rejecting this certitude and the concreteness, and we have this completely figured out versus okay.
That, and then it was so, and this is, you know, I didn't figure out these things until later, but I didn't like testimony meetings. Because, you know, everybody would get together, and especially, you know, we were all young people, and it would get really emotional, and everybody would talk about how certain they were about the gospel being true, and people would be crying and everything. And it just, at the time, you know, it just bugged me, you know, because I knew some of these kids. And there was a certain amount of hypocrisy there. There was, you know, it's high school. You know, it's a cruel and unusual place. And, you know, I got to admit, too, politically, I was always, I was born a leftist, I think, and at least a leftist wannabe, I should say it that way. But, you know, my dad had been in the union. I was really pro-union. I actually, you know, ended up in college because I won a scholarship from the AFL-CIO on, you know, why unions must participate in politics.
Really? Too fun. So, yeah, you're an unusual kid here. Obviously, the things that you were interested in, your mind gravitated towards, and the things that you weren't, you just couldn't care less.
Well, you know, it was, laziness was a big part, but also a kind of ADD, I think, nowadays people would call it, that I had a hard time in high school because, you know, you had to take 7 classes, and that just freaked me out. But the in the seminary, you know, later, I would come to think of it as a kind of, well, you have these intense social experiences at Nuremberg rallies and at tea parties and at rock concerts, too. You know? And that seemed to me to be kind of dangerous, that you would just kind of dissolve into this mass of good feelings. So, yes, you know, I dropped out of seminary. I was reading Mark Twain and Voltaire and people like that. But I was also reading Dostoevsky. And so by the time I got to college, I was fairly confused on all these things. I went to Utah State. I lived in the Mormon dorms up there. They don't exist anymore, but they, you know, had Mormon dorms. And I was a member of the Young Socialist Alliance at Utah State. I think there were 4 of us. And I got the militant. There was a guy there, Dane Goodwin, who probably wouldn't remember me because, like I say, I was a Marxist wannabe. I couldn't commit to really going out there and doing what needed to be done. But you know, I believed in the possibility of the revolution. There was that great song from back then, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." Do you remember this?
Not really.
YouTube it. It's really fabulous. One of the big disappointments of my life is it never happened. I you know, some people are disappointed because Jesus hasn't come back. I was disappointed because the revolution never happened. But anyway,
too funny.
There came to be a point where I had to make a decision. You know, I was 18, and I had to decide whether or not I was going to go on a mission.
And okay, so you had done a year at Utah State before this decision? Is that what?
I was doing my freshman year.
Okay.
I was 18, I was just turning 19, you know, and everybody else was going, and there was, you know, there's a lot of pressure. You know about this. I've heard your stories. You rebelled against it.
I just went the other direction, that's for sure, yeah.
But there was a lot of, you know, pressure to go. Everybody, you know, like in my ward at home, liked me, and when I'd get up and I'd mouth Marxist stuff in the ward, you know, people would just kind of say, "Oh, it's okay. He's Jim McLaughlin's kid. You know, it's he'll be all right."
And it wasn't like, "Oh, he's talking law of consecration here. Ooh, how spiritual."
No, I hadn't figured out law of consecration yet. I think I told you once at this point. Well, my mother had read the Book of Mormon, and we'd done a lot of talking about such things. But the only scriptures I'd read before I went on my mission was the Song of Solomon. And that was because somebody told me it had to do with sex.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I had a couple of wonderful cousins, though, who I was staying with. They were both returned missionaries. They were from the non-Jack Mormon side of the family when I was up there. And I had great talks with them about stuff. They couldn't believe I was Uncle Jim's kid because, you know, how could I be a lefty and so messed up about so many things, at least from their point of view. But anyway, I had a talk with my father one night, and he was such a gentle human being. He was just sweet. You know, he died 4 years ago, and I miss him tremendously. But we were talking, and we were talking about whether or not I'd go on a mission. And he looked at me and he said, "Jimmy, you know, you don't have to go if you don't want to." And right at that moment, I looked in his eyes and I, oh, hell, I've got to go. I could tell it would break his heart if I didn't go. And you know, people say that's the wrong reason to go, but I have come to believe, and we'll talk about this when we get into the actual theology, that's the at least for me, that was the best possible reason to go, because I looked into the man's eyes and I saw God. It wasn't, you know, Joseph Smith with the vision of the, you know, in the grove or whatever people, you know, feel these feelings. I saw God because I loved him, you know? And I felt the same way about my mother, so I decided to go on a mission. And
that's beautiful.
Well, you know, it was pretty miserable, actually.
Okay. Well, beautiful. I saw God. Now, the miserable part is your mission, or what?
No, the miserable part is that I loved my father. I didn't realize that I'd seen God yet.
I see. Yeah, good call.
I went into the language training mission down there in Provo before it was the MTC. This is, you know, ancient times. I got called to France, which was good because that's where I wanted to go, even though I hadn't said that I wanted to go there because I loved everything French. It was a great country for leftism and, the French Revolution. And I loved philosophy, and it was a great country for that. I had been a history major, by the way, up to this point. And up to this point, too, I thought I wanted to be a union lawyer. So I end up on this mission. I go down to the LTM, and I read the book. I read all the standard works while I was there for that 2 months trying to learn French. I read Jesus the Christ and the Articles of Faith, and, you know, I kept waiting for this, you know, big experience to happen, and it kept not happening. I read a good deal of the teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith, and toward the end of my time at the LTM, I read the King Follett Discourse for the first time. You know, I'd heard people talk about it as I grew up, but I read it for the first time, and I thought, I think I can believe this, because if you go back to that Mark Twain mysterious stranger thing, and like I said, my dad was a big B.H. Roberts guy and Widtsoe guy, so I'd heard talk about these things, but I read that and I thought, the idea that God is one of us, the idea that God developed through time, that God isn't in complete control of everything and sort of a tyrant torturer.
You know? Right, right.
That I thought, yeah, this is, you know, I wasn't spiritually converted this time, but intellectually that made really good sense to me. The Book of Mormon I thought was a really nice book. It's had nice things in it. I really like 2 Nephi chapter 2. Thought it was great, you know, that opposition in all things. But then we got this 2 Nephi chapter 3 about there will be this guy Joseph and everything. Oh, come on. Joseph Smith writing this, predicting his own greatness. I mean, I had people, you know, yeah, you know. Anyway, but there were things in it I just, you know, they just kind of too much, you know, like 2,000 stripling warriors, none of them even gets wounded. Oh, well, they get wounded, none of them get killed. You know, there was just stuff like that that for me at that time were just, you know, they were just beyond the possibility. And then, you know, reading the Book of Joshua and the, you know, the kill them all, even the babies. it seemed like Mark Twain was right about a lot of these things. But anyway,
so you're in the LTM and you're at least beginning to have a reason to go. I'm getting a little more excited because at least I know I can explore this angle. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah, and I'm in the LTM and I'm falling in love with philosophy too, because I get fascinated with this idea that there's all this really disturbing stuff in the scriptures. There's all this kind of what I would at the time thought was crazy stuff in the scriptures, and then there's all this cool stuff in the scriptures. You know, and that, you know, just the fact that there was so much in there, the old 70s expression, blew my mind, kind of a thing. You know, but I didn't have a testimony. And when I got to finally got to France, I remember telling my missionary, my mission president. Plus, this was a time when, you know, the civil rights movement was going on, and we hadn't figured that one out yet. Which seemed to me pretty awful. You know, because people will say that Mormons weren't racist. You know, sometimes. I grew up in a society of people who had never met a black person but were incredibly racist. But one of the things I have to say for them, that often when they met a black person, they somehow didn't see they were black. Oh, this is a human being. So they overcame their ideas. But anyway, I got out on my mission. I remember telling my mission president this, and he said, well, you know, just say you believe what you believe, and, you know, you can leave it at that. And then I told him, you know, I think that I will go mad if I have to just read Mormon stuff for my whole mission. And he said to me, well, you can read anything you want to read, just read it in French.
Mm.
Which, you know, I don't know if they do that anymore. They probably don't. But he even gave me a list of books. Montaigne, Pascal. And so I got loose and on my mission. And I was every Friday I would get up. And I would, you know, have all these French books, and it was a real motivator to learn to read and to learn French. You know, everything else is a real motivator too when you're out there. But so I read the scriptures again voraciously, and I tried to read, you know, all the philosophy that I could. But it took me, I was out there for about a year, and I read the King Follett Discourse kind of over and over and over again. And I guess at a certain point, I had two big sort of experiences that I don't think other people would see as, you know, great spiritual experiences, but they were for me. One was in my first town, Besançon. I was so frustrated. I tried all the stuff that happens in the Book of Mormon, you know, the King Limhi stuff, and you know, lay down on the floor and, you know, give all your sins away and all that. You know, nothing happened, you know. Felt like words were falling on the pavement. But, you know, so one day I walked out to, and this will sound silly to most of your listeners, but it sounds silly to me, but one day I walked out and got on my bike and I shook my fist at heaven and said, okay, it's your turn. And I was really distracted and I almost got run over by a truck. So
interesting.
So I pulled off the side of the road and said, okay, I'll wait. I'll just keep trying. But then I got to my second town, and I would always talk to all the communists and Marxists and socialists. And there was a guy who was worked for the railroad, great guy. And I remember having a really intense conversation with him about God. And he looked at me and said, "You believe this stuff?" And you know, right. And once again, just like when my father looked at me, it was this experience of, yeah, I can believe that you are divine. That is true. And at a certain point in my mission, I just decided that's what I believed. And so I
believe that other people are fundamentally good versus just fallen creatures, that kind of thing.
Well, not that they're fundamentally good, but that they are divine, that we are these creatures that are in a struggle. You know, and part of this is as much, well, it's 2 Nephi chapter 2, you know, the opposition in all the things that goes all the way down. And I mean, by all the way down, I mean even with God, you know, it goes all the way down. There's this tremendous struggle going on between good and evil that's in all of us. And it's not, I make that sound like it's more a Manichaean dualistic universe. I don't mean that. When we get into talking philosophy, we can talk about why that's not the case. I do think there's a struggle in us about, and it's a proper struggle. It's a struggle that, you know, Mosiah talks about when he says the natural man is an enemy to God, that we have these desires to be individual, but we have also this need for community with others, for loving others, for getting beyond ourselves. And that struggle itself is an indication of the divine in us. We're not just selfish bastards. And, you know, this man that I was talking to was such a wonderful person. You know, he was committed to the union there. But he also, you know, he wasn't going to go out and kill people over it. And he was committed to making a better life for his family. He was just a good man. You know, I would meet these people all through my mission. There was a Protestant minister who ran a home for homeless people. And, you know, we would hang out with him and with the homeless guys. And, you know, we didn't do much, but they were, you know, all the drunks in town knew us and liked us. So that was good. And I met these, they called them worker priests. The worker priest movement was big in France. And these incredible guys that would, you know, they were priests, but they were working in factories with, you know, working class folks. And it just seemed that the best things about religion were, and I thought Mormonism had this in it, to recognize the divinity right here in our brothers and sisters that surround us, and not just in something that was up in heaven, you know, far, far away. And so, you know, I kind of went through my mission with that. And, you know, the mission got better. You know, France is a tough place. I worked in Burgundy, Beaujolais, and Provence, three of the biggest wine-making regions in France. And, you know, if folks liked you, they'd let you in, and they'd offer you a glass of wine, and then they wouldn't be interested in Mormonism anymore, you know, because wine was a bigger part of the French religion than Catholicism was.
Right.
So it was, but they were, the French were fabulous. I mean, these people could laugh. I mean, it was, oh, gosh. I spent 3 months in Switzerland. And the Swiss were all, like, you know, incredibly polite, but very cold. The French were all incredibly rude and just wonderful.
Yeah, so. Very cool. I'm wondering what your companions thought of you. I mean, you're, well, I'm going to seek out all the leftists and Marxists in every town I go to. So, were they looking at you as this bizarre creature, or were they just going along for the ride and enjoying meeting these kinds of people, too?
I had great companions. They were fabulous people. I would just... some of them, you know, maybe more than others, but they were all good guys. I had one companion who was a jazz drummer. He was from California. He was the straightest looking Mormon guy you ever saw, and yet it was being away from his drums was killing him.
And
he would just get going. And we were in Montreux together, you know, where the big jazz festival was. And the rule was we couldn't go to it. But after I got transferred, I got a letter from him saying that he'd gone to it. And I was so proud of him.
All right.
But anyway, we worked hard. They thought I was a little weird maybe. But they were good people who worked and who were trying to, not just self-righteous little freaks, but who were actually trying to help people, because, you know, the church was always struggling in France. And the members of the church were fabulous. They were just, you know, kind people. I met the most amazing man of my life while I was over there. You know, I mentioned my problems with the priesthood ban. Now, I was there 74 to 76, 2 years before the priesthood ban was lifted. And I met two people, a fellow from Zaire, who was, you know, we baptized a couple of people, but this guy didn't get baptized, but he was the easiest guy to teach that I had met. And we got about halfway through the lessons, and I had to get to the part, you know, where I told him that about the priesthood ban. And fortunately, you know, in the 60s, President McKay had issued that statement for reasons known to God, but only known not unknown to man, but only to God. So all the idiot stuff about, you know, not being valiant in the pre-existence wasn't necessarily the case. But I had to tell him this, and it was like the worst moment of my mission, having to tell this guy, who was a much better human being than I was, that he couldn't have the priesthood. And he said, well, you know, if the guy's a prophet, there must be something to this, which I wasn't ready for, but that once again showed him that he was a much better man than I was. And so I met him, and then there was another guy in the last town I was in. I was down on the Riviera in San Rafael, and we were the only people dressed. It was a really difficult place to be in the summer. There were incredibly beautiful women walking around and not much. but there was a guy in the branch there, Monsieur Bourdin, who he had married a woman who had ended up in a mental institution. And she'd had 5 or 6 kids, and he'd taken them. And he was a truck driver who lived in government housing. And he, once again, a black fellow, and he was a saint, you know, in the real sense of this. He kind of, all the kids in the housing unit were always over at his, and the housing development were always over at his place. He was taking care of them. He was, you could feel the goodness just kind of ooze out of this guy. He was just kind. He was happy, and he led the music, and every week we sang Onward Christian Soldiers, and he would make the place, you know, we only had 20 people, but he would make the place, it rocked. Okay? I mean, it was just great. And, you know, he's one of those guys, when you meet him, you say, you know, sometime in my life I would like to be like him. And so, you know, and then I came home from my mission, and, well, one last thing about my mission. I'd been over there, and this is, you'll appreciate because you do process theology. I had met a woman. We became friends, her and her husband and me, and because we sit around and talk theology. Then I'd gotten transferred. Well, she had told me a book that she had told me I should read Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Protestant theologian. And I, you know, I was 20. And I couldn't remember the name Bonhoeffer. That's a hard name to remember. But I remember the name, the guy's name began with a B, and he died heroically in World War II.
He'd be an interesting person for a lot of our listeners to get to know, because he was a Hitler, and, you know, he was a Nazi hater. And I mean, he was trying to fight against it, and he got caught up in a plot to execute or to murder Hitler, and ended up being executed by the Nazis towards the end of the war, right? But fantastic, wonderful theologian.
I didn't read him, though, because I got confused. This was one of those productive mistakes.
Okay.
I got my dictionary. I had a little French dictionary of philosophy, and B, and died heroically in World War II. And I was going through it, and I come across this guy, Henri Bergson.
Bergson, yeah.
Yeah, he was Jewish, but he had contemplated conversion to Christianity. But then decided not to because he said the darkness was approaching and he wanted to stay with the people in the dark part of the picture. But he because he had won the Nobel Prize in Literature, one of the few philosophers to do it, he had been granted a Jewish immunity. Yeah, you like that, by the Vichy government. But he stood up, he was in his 80s at the time, and he went out and he stood in the rain for several hours so he could register himself as a Jew. So that was heroic. But so I started reading Bergson, and you know, I loved it. You know, it's kind of process theology stuff. And I got his last book, The Two Sources of Morality and Religion, which is one of the fabulous books. And it dealt with things in ways that were in just this really interesting way. And I was reading this on my mission and not understanding at all, but at least getting some. One was that he said there's two sources to religion. One is the conservative, what he called the closed source. But he says this is absolutely necessary to religion. It's social. It preserves what has been revealed. It's institutional. But it is also... can be oppressive. The other source he called the open source. It was revelatory. He associates this with the mystics, he and the prophets, and it's open to, you know, new innovations in religion. He says, now, both of them are good, but both of them can kind of tumble off into a kind of evil. The one, obviously, because it's repressive, it tends to close itself and become dogmatic. But the other one can wander off into flights of fancy and into kind of utter chaos, you know, just going here and there and everywhere, you know, like Sunstone.
But, oh, man.
I love Sunstone.
Rip.
I'm saying fun. But there is a possibility sometimes that we get so...
For sure.
So open to our own spiritual experiences that we wander off into la-la land.
But
I go to Sunstone all the time. I love Sunstone. I consider myself a Sunstoner, but that's our temptation. Now, if you go to church, it's the other temptation. That'll be repressive and dark, and, you know, either one of them has their temptations. But anyway.
Exactly.
The last line in that book, and I didn't understand the book very well, but it really got me excited, was that humanity must realize that the universe is a machine for creating God. Very last line in two sources. And I was like, he's a Mormon. We try to baptize a lot of people that can't be baptized, like, you know, C.S. Lewis. But I don't know. But for me at the time, that was an incredible revelation.
Very cool. So this is at the end of your mission, and so you're excited, and all this stuff is going good. So
yeah, I go home.
Tell us about what
my mission president. I was going to go home, and I was going to go to either the U or Utah State because I'd sworn I'd never go to BYU. But my mission president talked me into going to BYU, and I'm glad I did. I mean, I went there, and the best thing that happened to me there was I met my wife. And I met her in all the ways that you're not supposed to, you are supposed to, okay? All the, what would you call them, cliche ways. I was, you know, studying there. I had never been so lonely in my life. And I go to family home evening. Okay, you know, that's what it's set up for. And there she is. And I look at her and she just seemed, it's one of those experiences, like I was talking to with my dad and this fellow in France, like a nice person. You know, like somebody who's kind. And I went over and we talked about Mark Twain. She was an English major, you know, which is another, you know. And we talked about Mark Twain, and I was totally smitten. And I didn't see her again for about 3 weeks. And finally, I got a date with her. We went and listened to Jacob Neusner, the Jewish scholar, speak at BYU. And then I took her to see Taming of the Shrew, and by that time I was head over heels in love, and a week later we got engaged. I don't know if she was head over heels in love with me. She said she knew, when I asked her to marry me, I was sitting under my punching bag in my basement apartment. It wasn't very romantic. But I was overwhelmed with love. And she said, I know I'm going to marry you. I took that as a yes. Apparently she didn't. But the next day, my sister worked at O.C. Tanner. So I had $30 to my name. But my sister forced me to get a ring for her and gave me a diamond, which was really nice. And I just had to buy the setting. A couple of months later, we got married. I was totally worthless during the whole time we were engaged. So I flunked a couple of classes.
you needed to hurry and get married so you could get back to being able to concentrate.
I can only think of one thing at a time. So it was, and we've been married 34 years now. It's the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. If anything,
Carrie is wonderful. I know Carrie, and she is fantastic. So,
yeah. Well, I guess that brings us. Well, you know, after BYU, I went back to France. Carrie and I did with our young child Jimmy, and he was only a month old. And I taught French history for BYU study abroad there for 6 months. I thought I was going to stay and do a master's in philosophy at the Sorbonne, because I'd been, one thing my mission had done is, you know, and this is for good or ill, I don't know how you want to think of it, it had pulled me so into philosophy, trying to figure out this God question, that I decided I wasn't going to be a union lawyer, which, you know, like I say, you know, depends on what you want, theologians or union lawyers. But I probably, you know, I don't know if I would have been a good union lawyer or not. But anyway, so I go to BYU, I go to Paris, I sit in on classes on Heidegger at the Sorbonne. But I, you know, I figure, well, you know, we can't afford to live here because there's three of us. We go back and I get into Indiana University and I'm doing European intellectual history. It was really interesting, but I decided that I walked over. My advisor in history said, you know, you shouldn't be in history. You should be in religious studies. I didn't even know what religious studies was. They didn't have it at BYU. And I said, well, you know, our church doesn't have ministers. And he said, that's not what religious studies is. So I went over to the religious studies department. I started taking classes from a guy named Jim Hart, who was a incredible polymath. He knew everything. He'd read every book. And he said he recommended to me that I read Nikolai Berdyaev, the Russian theologian, who I eventually wrote part of my dissertation on. Then I took a class in Jean-Paul Sartre from a guy named Paul Spade, which was, and read, I owned Being and Nothingness. I'd read parts of it on my mission, didn't understand any of it. But I took the class with him, and it was, you know, the world opened up again. And so I decided to leave history, and I went up to the University of Toronto and did philosophy of religion in the Center for Religious Studies at the University of Toronto, and you know, studied Russian philosophy, Berdyaev and those people, but also spent a lot of time with Hegel and Schelling and Heidegger and, you know, names that might mean something to the listeners. I actually got more converted to the church in Toronto than I had been on my mission, because we were in an inner city ward and these people were struggling and they were good people and they were trying so hard, and it was just such a pleasure to be with them. But anyway, so I did my studies there, got, you know, I had a fellowship. We went from Indiana, from Toronto back to Indiana, where Carrie did her master's degree in religious studies, and I worked with Jim Hart some more. And then we came back to Utah, where we existed in poverty for several years as I wrote my dissertation. You know how this goes. And I decided to write my dissertation. It came to me in priesthood meeting, because there's an idea in Sartre called the desire to be God. And he thinks this is the what he calls not human nature, but the human condition, that we desire to be God. And for him, that's largely a negative thing, and we can talk about this in a minute. But it came to me in priesthood as I was sitting there listening to, you know, my brothers talking about becoming gods, like going up the corporate ladder of success. And that just didn't seem like a good thing to me. So I wrote it. So I used Sartre's idea of the desire to be God. There's nothing about Mormons in this whole dissertation, but it was all in the background. That's what I was thinking about all the time. And then coupled that with Nikolai Berdyaev's notion of becoming like God, which is a notion of self-emptying, of relationship to the other. And that was my dissertation, which eventually became published as a book that I think four people read.
Woohoo!
Yeah, it's the, you know, scholarly stuff. I'd like to get back to it sometime, because it really still interests me. But anyway, so we lived out there in Taylorsville while I wrote this. I taught at Westminster. I taught at part-time at Utah. It was Utah Technical College then, not UVU. And I taught part-time at BYU, both in the philosophy department and in the religion department. The BYU stuff kind of dried up, and I was still teaching at Westminster and Utah Tech. But one of the great experiences, we were living out on the old farm in Taylorsville, and it was a two-room house, not a two-bedroom house. And we had three kids, and we were in this little two-room house. And my cousins, who were both construction workers, lived out there too, and they used to kind of look at me and say, well, Jimmy, you were the smart one. What happened? But I remember they'd get drunk, you know, and independently. And whenever they got, not whenever they got drunk, but sometimes when they got drunk, they'd come down and want to talk religion. You know? And so I'd have these wonderful conversations with my semi-drunk cousins.
One spirit leading to a different type of spirit. Yeah,
exactly. Well, it opened them up. I mean, you know, they were more open to the spirit than I was. They'd go down there and they'd feel kind of the presence of the ancestors. They regarded it as a kind of sacred spot. And it was always wonderful to talk to them. And they had really profound things to say, even when they were slightly inebriated, about the problem of suffering, because, you know, their family had gone through significant amounts of that. Justice and it was a fascinating part of my theological education, just talking to those guys. But anyway, I got really sick, and I just wanted to, I was teaching at Westminster at the time, and they put me on phenobarbital. It was an asthma condition, and I was really kind of trippy for a little while, even though I was giving lectures on Thomas Hobbes. But I just wanted to finish my dissertation and find a job. And I remember calling BYU to ask them if they could just hire me for the summer so I could have some money to finish my dissertation. And they said, well, we're going to hire you next year for a year appointment. And I remember hanging up the phone and wondering if I'd hallucinated it. And so when I went down to talk with the department head a couple of weeks later, I was really careful to try and I was trying to get him to say that they were going to hire me because I wasn't sure that they had. Finally, I just came out and said, did you guys want to hire me next year? And they looked at me kind of strange and said, yes. So I got the job at BYU for a year. I taught there for a year and then got my job at Western Carolina. And in 1991, it was 1991 when the six got excommunicated, right?
93,
yeah. That hit me as quite a blow, and I contemplated leaving the church at the time. But a year later, I kept going to church, and a year later, this will sound really incredibly self-serving, but it's not. We moved from our apartment. We finally raised enough money for a down payment on a house. We moved from our apartment to our house, and the ward showed up to help us move. And I just wanted them to move some furniture, but they moved everything. They packed everything up. They just moved us. And I had this just same experience, you know, that these are wonderful people. How could I ever give this up? You know, it was splendid, you know, these beautiful people, you know, terrible problems in their own lives, some of them, but, you know, doing the right thing, helping somebody else, you know, I could never give that up. And I've taught seminary and institute since then. I don't know why, but I'm on the high council now out here, you know, that in my stake that's 200 miles across. You live old enough and you stay around long enough, they stick you on the high council. But ever since that event, I've really, you know, I still struggle with theological ideas, but I don't struggle with the idea of ever leaving. You know, there's a sense in which it's true. Now, the sense in which it's true, like I say, is going to be fairly eccentric for me. But that's my biography part of this, and I probably talked too long, but. This is what I'm committed to. It's like I'm committed to my wife as the most beautiful person on the planet. I'm not saying everybody else has to follow me, but, they're wrong. She is. And same thing here with Mormonism. Mormonism is the true faith. Why? Because I love it. And, you know, I admire Buddhists. I admire Taoists. I admire atheists. But and there's a lot of truth there, but they're wrong.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, I loved hearing this, and I think our listeners will love it. So let's make that the sort of the close of the biography section. And I'm sure as we go along here, you'll illustrate with other pieces of your life as it goes. But let's close this first segment of conversation and move into another one. So, does that work for you?
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Oh, all is well, all is well.
Just we shall dwell.